Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program number 481, an interview with John Buchanan, being recorded on October 9th of the year 2004. And once again, it's my pleasure to bring back to our airwaves John Buchanan. John, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to continue the discussion.
Now, we were talking about your articles for the New Hampshire Gazette, in which you accessed declassified U.S. government documents that prove the involvement of the Bush family with Nazi industry. There have been a number of things that have come out as a result of those articles that you published in the New Hampshire Gazette. One of them, very happily, was an enterprising website put together by some listeners to this program in the Midwest. Tell us about that.
There's an organization called the National Association of Critically Thinking Teenagers, and I was contacted by a couple of teachers in the Midwest who are listeners of your program who are involved with that organization and who had become aware of my stories in the New Hampshire Gazette. So they were interested in not only the educational aspects of bringing the story to teenagers in high school history classes, but more importantly, they were interested in having these teenagers work on a project of actually posting all of my documents on a website so that the American people and journalists and news organizations could see for themselves. Not only did they accomplish that, but they did a masterful job, and the website is www.debatecomics.org/Bush Family Fortune. Debate Comics, like comic magazine, debatecomics.org/Bush Family Fortune. And so your listeners and anyone else who has an interest in knowing the truth about this story can spend a few hours reading all of the documents and reaching their own conclusion about what they mean and what the implications are for the present era of the Bush regime.
Indeed. Once again, that address, and by the way, it is linked to the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. The address, once again, is www.debatecomics, one word, DABATECOMICS.org. /Bush Family Fortune, one word, but with the B in Bush and the F's in Family and Fortune capitalized. And then there's a link to the Spitfire website so you can access work that was a follow-up, a wonderful follow-up, to the heroic work done by John Loftus in the New Hampshire Gazette. And that website also features copyrighted introductions to the documents by you.
Correct, right. I had written cover sheets for each batch of documents to explain very briefly in a paragraph or two what you're going to be looking at with the next batch of documents. So they posted everything, so it's very clear and simple to navigate your way through.
And in addition to that very gratifying feedback, and by the way, I would hold up those listeners in the Midwest to the rest of the listening audience as examples, archetypes for the civic action that I think is going to be required for people to relieve ourselves from the current malaise, and it is considerable. But that's the way to go. Just enterprise, undertake to do stuff, and stuff will get done. John, as a result of your New Hampshire Gazette articles, you've had other types of feedback that were less gratifying than what our listeners in the Midwest have put together. Tell us about some of the harrowing experiences that you've had as a result of the New Hampshire Gazette.
Well, what happened, the link between the two phases was that my first Bush Nazi article was published in the New Hampshire Gazette on Friday, October 10th of 2003. And on Monday morning, over that first weekend of the 11th and 12th of October, the story sprang up on about 75 major websites all over the world, including Take Back the Media, Rents.com, BuzzFlash.com, and a few others in the U.S. And so the story got a lot of traction right off the bat. And on Monday morning, October 13th, I got a phone call from John McConnell, the 89-year-old founder of Earth Day, who lives in Denver. And strangely enough, based on his having read the Bush Nazi article over the weekend, he told me that I was the kind of person who had the courage and conviction to change the country and that I should run for president. I discounted him in the first conversation as a kooky old man, but I found out that he was, in fact, the founder of Earth Day and that he had known 33 Nobel Prize winners in his lifetime. And over the next several weeks, he, as a Republican, convinced me to run for president against Bush in the New Hampshire primary as a journalist, not as a politician, as the truth candidate, to try to force the issue that the American people understand and accept the Nazi past of the family. So I left on January 2nd and I moved up to New Hampshire to run against Bush in the New Hampshire Republican primary. I performed a minor political miracle, which was by talking every day about the Bush family's Nazi past and not my economic plan. I tied for second place in the New Hampshire primary and, in fact, beat 12 other Republican candidates. And as a result of that, I was asked to speak at the National Press Club on February 4th, and I stayed up in New Hampshire. So on the morning of Wednesday, February 4th, I flew down from Manchester, New Hampshire, on Southwest Airlines to Baltimore, Washington, to speak at the National Press Club. And when I arrived at noon at Baltimore, Washington Airport, I was taken off of my flight by two men who were introduced to me by someone who claimed to be from the Baltimore, Washington Airport police that the Secret Service wanted to talk to me. Needless to say, my heart rose into my throat and my voice rose to an operatic range by the time I stepped off the airplane. But I did muster enough courage to ask them to show me some identification. There were two of them, a blonde good cop and a brunette, dark-haired, very menacing bad cop. The bad cop, so-called Secret Service agent, said to me, these badges hanging on our belts are the only identification you need to see. You are in deep, deep trouble. They led me into an interrogation room that is now believed to have been an INS interrogation facility, and they viciously interrogated me for 2.5 hours, claiming that they had a tip, an anonymous tip from New Hampshire, that I was leading a plot to assassinate Bush. After 2.5 hours, they let me go, and I went and made my speech at the press club that night. The next morning, February 5th, I woke up and came up with the bright idea of going as a Republican presidential candidate to the Capitol and demanding a meeting with the Republican staff of the House Judiciary Committee, and I did that. And I met for 2 hours with a general counsel whose name was Rob Tracy, T-R-A-C-C-I, and a Republican investigator named Thad Bingell, B-I-N-G-E-L. They listened to me for 2 hours. They went online and saw the Bush Nazi stories. They went online and saw my presidential website. And they promised me a congressional inquiry into what had happened. They never responded to my phone calls or emails ever again, which is probably no surprise to you and your listeners. It was something of a surprise to me. At the end of the two-hour meeting, they asked me what I was most afraid of. And I said, well, to be honest, what I'm most afraid of is that I've lived in New Hampshire for 5 weeks, and I'm very afraid that since this happened, that I'll go home to Miami and get arrested for something I didn't do. I'm going home to Jeb Bush's state, and I've been out making speeches about the fact that his brother is a war criminal and a descendant of Nazi sympathizers. And they both went up, you see, John, now you've turned into a conspiracy nut. Why would anybody arrest you? I rode the train home that afternoon of February 5th. I got home to Miami on late on the afternoon of Friday, February 6th. And on Tuesday morning, February 10th, I was arrested in my apartment on 14 counts of aggravated felony stalking against a victim they could never produce in court. I was dragged into court 4 times between my arraignment in early March and my trial on August 16th. And even my public defender betrayed me. And when I went to Miami the final time on August 11th, and my own attorney, my public defender, said to me, well, John, I've got some really bad news. We've lost your defense. You have no defense. Your witness list and your alibi list, et cetera, have been mysteriously lost, and there's an excellent chance you're going to go to prison, and I really don't know what to tell you. So I begged her, Ayanna, I don't know what to do. I'm innocent. I'm going to go to prison for something I didn't do. Please help me. And she actually looked at me and said, I really don't have time to talk to you. I'm due back in court. I'll see you Monday morning for your trial. I just went into shock, Dave, and so I called someone I had gotten to know, an activist named Gabriel Day in Northern California, and he reassured me that he would get involved and help me. And so overnight, on the night of August 11th, he got together a committee to defend John Buchanan, and within 24 hours through the National Lawyers Guild, they got me a wonderful attorney, a woman named Rae Sharon, R-A-E Sharon, S-H-E-A-R-N in Miami. Through the National Lawyers Guild, she and I spoke by phone on Friday. She got the court file and reviewed my case over the weekend, and over the weekend told me that, you know, I had to realize that it was very rare for a state to dismiss felony charges against a defendant that the state actually wanted to try, but that based on the court file, my case was an outrageous miscarriage of justice, and that we would give it the best shot we could, but I had to be prepared for the fact that, you know, maybe they would put me on trial. And so we went to court Monday morning, August 16th. The judge still refused to dismiss the charges based on the objection of the state's attorney, who characterized me as a violent criminal who was a menace to the community. And Rae Sharon, God bless her, said, Your Honor, I have a capital murder case starting tomorrow, and I'm going to be indisposed for the next 6 weeks, and Mr. Buchanan has been maligned by the court, and therefore we demand to go to trial today. We're ready for trial. Well, I almost dropped dead because I already knew that my defense file was missing and I had no defense. And so the judge set the trial for 1:30 on August 16th. I sat in the courtroom and waited for 2 hours. We went to trial at 1:30, and my charges were dismissed at 1:34 because there was no victim, no witness, no cop, no evidence, no nothing. And the judge dismissed the charges against me and apologized to me. And I now intend to sue Miami-Dade County and the Miami Beach Police Department for malicious prosecution, and to try to prosecute the cop criminally for committing perjury and filing a false police report against me.
So in other words, they did not give you either the Pulitzer Prize nor the Congressional Medal of Honor.
By a long shot. you don't seem like a guy famous for understatement, but that's an understatement.
All righty. Obviously, it was deliberately so. John, you fortunately, that ordeal did not deter you from further efforts. You have been ferreting out more documents concerning the Bush family's Nazi connections. I wonder if I could, if next we could focus on some of your latest discoveries. Let's start with the new documents that you've gotten a hold of. Tell us about the Bush family and I.G. Farben.
Through a contact that I got through the Berlin Bureau of the Guardian newspaper of London, and after more than a month of discussions during which I sent them a number of the documents, the most significant documents from the original batch, the Guardian did an incredible thing. They dispatched one of their most renowned reporters, a gentleman named Duncan Campbell, who actually came from Afghanistan, where he had been reporting on the resurgence of the Taliban. And Duncan flew over to Washington and met me in Washington on August the 8th, and on Monday, August 9th, and Tuesday, August 10th, the 2 days before I had to leave to go to court in Miami, I took Duncan of the Guardian to the National Archives and the Library of Congress and showed him the actual original documents, because being a reputable and a major world newspaper, The Guardian was responsible enough to realize that they could not run any risk that my documents were forged copies, and they wanted to see the originals. So Duncan Campbell spent one day at the archives with me and one day at the Library of Congress with me, and they were prepared to report the story, which they did a couple of weeks ago. But the day that we were at the Library of Congress, and also the day we were at the archives, he went into Washington to meet some of his colleagues for lunch, and he left me alone for an extended lunch hour both days. So on the day that I was at the archives, on my own, I found documents. There are dozens and dozens of boxes of documents that were also only declassified and approved for public release in September of 2003. And they are the thousands of pages of documents from the extensive FBI investigation of the U.S. business relationships of IG Farben, the industrial cartel that literally built and was the backbone of the Nazi war machine and manufactured the poison gases for the death. They were a large chemical company of which Bayer is a direct descendant. And they, during the war, were also the operators and managers of the death camp at Auschwitz. And so on August 10th, the day before I went to Miami to go to court, I finally found what no one had ever been able to find, which was documents that linked Brown Brothers Harriman and Bush and the Harrimans to IG Farben, and therefore to the death of the Jews and others at Auschwitz. Among those documents is a 1942 letter from J. Edgar Hoover to the Secretary of the Treasury, which directly links their business dealings, their secret covered-up business dealings in the U.S. after the U.S. had entered the war and after the Holocaust had begun to IG Farben. There was a German journalist, her name is Eva Schweitzer, and she had contacted me from finding me on the internet back in the spring, and she published this very week, as a matter of fact, in Germany, in German, a very explosive book called The USA and the Holocaust. And she had asked me to help her go recreate my work at the National Archives and Library of Congress to see all the documents. And so I had done that for her beginning last spring, and she had also seen all of the documents. She was also interviewed by The Guardian, and 2 weeks ago today, The Guardian printed a major story on the Bush connection, including the connection to IG Farben and therefore to Auschwitz. A week and a half ago, Eva went back to the archives on her own, and she found and has in her possession even more documents that show that Brown Brothers Harriman, in which Prescott Bush and the Harrimans were partners and shareholders, that Brown Brothers Harriman in turn were shareholders in IG Farben and therefore were complicit in the death camp at Auschwitz. She also found new documents that showed that according to the FBI, Brown Brothers Harriman helped smuggle Nazi assets into Chile and were complicit in the cover-up of the smuggling of those assets into Chile. And Eva is in Berlin now talking to The Guardian about an even more explosive follow-up story. And I am now more determined than ever, based on the failure of The Guardian story, to get any ink in the U.S. to fight until the end to make sure that this story gets out to the American people, whether it's before the election or after the election.
All right. John, real quickly, we are running low on time here, so we're going to have to move quickly. The documents that you have uncovered, you've come across some interesting information about the Hamburg America Line. Tell us about that.
Correct. Now, those were also those were discovered by me just last week. And I was in Washington organizing an event at the National Press Club for my book tour on October 26th, and I went I report in my book the attempt of some of America's wealthiest families in 1934 to overthrow the U.S. government, assassinate FDR, and abolish the office of the presidency and replace it with what in effect is a civil dictatorship. That coup attempt in 1934 was facilitated by a secret organization called the American Liberty League, in which Prescott Bush played an early role. So that means that Prescott Bush was complicit in a coup attempt to overthrow the government of the United States. Those hearings, which many of your listeners, I'm sure, are familiar with, were conducted by the McCormick-Dickstein Committee of the U.S. House of Representatives, and I went there to just see those documents and confirm them. But in the same batch of microfilm that included those hearings from November of 1934, I found hearings from June of 1934 that were a secret inquiry into Nazi activities in the U.S. and included an extensive inquiry into Hamburg America Line, the first business seized in 1942, which I already talked about. It had been rumored and written about for decades, that Hamburg America Line had smuggled Nazi spies into the U.S. in the late 1920s and early 1930s, that they had given free passage to Germany to American citizens who would go over and proselytize for Hitler and things like that. And I now have in my possession from the McCormick-Dickstein Committee transcripts proof of that as well. In addition to corroborating all of those decades-old reports and rumors, I also found the documents that show that they secretly funded a Nazi newspaper. They funded and backed brown shirt operations that distributed anti-Semitic literature in New York. They funded a Nazi group run by Nazis sent over from Germany called the Friends of the New Germany, etc. And they also were involved in the publication of a book reportedly written by Paul Warburg that suggested that the Jews were an inferior race who should be exterminated, and which was published in the U.S. and sold in a bookstore in New York City. And so I now have those documents in my possession as well, and I would hope that before the election on November 2nd, the American people on a very large scale in churches and synagogues and mosques and schools and colleges and workplaces and labor unions, you name it, by word of mouth, starting tonight, if the New York Times and Washington Post won't do it, that the American people on a large scale would become aware over the next 3 weeks that the grandfather of the incumbent president of the United States was involved in an attempt to overthrow the U.S. government, kill FDR, and abolish the office of the presidency and institute a Hitler-like fascist regime. And perhaps then they will understand, those who still claim that they back him and will vote for him, they will come to understand the significance of the fact that we invaded a country without cause and overthrew its president and are torturing people at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay, and that our constitutional rights are being stolen under the Patriot Act. And perhaps then the American people, especially Republicans and evangelical Christians, will come to understand that we are in a very grave set of circumstances, and that the pattern of behavior that led to Nazi Germany is repeating itself in 2004, and we can do something to stop them before it is too late. That is my dream, and that is my only goal and my only motivation in being on the radio with you or talking to anyone else I can talk to for the next 3 weeks, day or night.
And so summing up, the McCormick-Dickstein Committee documents that you've accessed describe those various Nazi activities in the U.S. prior to the war, and they also document Prescott Bush Sr.'s involvement with the Liberty League, and that was the consortium of fascist industrialists and financiers who tried to overthrow Roosevelt in 1934.
And the interesting connection there is the Bush family connection to Remington Arms, which was owned by the DuPont family. The great-grandfather of this president, Prescott Bush's father, was Samuel Bush, and he was a war profiteer and collaborated with Remington Arms in World War I. And someone who Samuel Bush worked with in World War One, who was an infamous war profiteer and war criminal, was an American named Samuel Pryor, whose escapades in World War One were chronicled in the famous book, The Merchants of Death. And Samuel Pryor was a principal in Union Banking Corp, UBC, the granddaddy of the Nazi front businesses operated by Fritz Thyssen, and Samuel Pryor was also involved in Brown Brothers Harriman.
And as we've spoken about, the veteran listeners to the show are familiar with For the Record 475, talking about Remington Arms, their projected role in the 1934 coup attempt, and also Samuel Pryor's son and his attempts to coordinate with Nazi agents in the United States to overthrow Roosevelt in 1940. But your McCormick-Dickstein documents actually link Prescott Bush Sr. to the Liberty League and to the 34th Coup Party.
Not the McCormick-Dickstein documents themselves. Other documentation that's pretty well established that the Prescott Bush was an early progenitor of the American Liberty League. That's well established, but it's not in the McCormick-Dickstein committee documents. It is well documented that Prescott Bush was involved in American Liberty League, but that is not mentioned, nor are the Harrimans, nor are George Herbert Walker in the McCormick-Dickstein committee hearings.
Okay, I just wanted to clarify that.
Yeah.
So you do have the documents, but they're not from McCormick-Dickstein.
Correct.
Okay, good. Real quickly, John, tell us about your book. And this got
okay.
to be fast.
My book is titled Fixing America, Breaking the Stranglehold of Corporate Rule, Big Media, and the Religious Right. And the book covers, in a couple of chapters, the story of my Bush Nazi stories and how the New York Times and the major media would not and still will not cover them. It also, in a section called Are We Living in a Neo-Fascist State, covers the coup attempt in a couple of chapters of 1934 and the American Liberty League and Prescott Bush and so on. But the real premise of my book is that corporations rule this country, that corporate lobbyists are the de facto rulers of this country and the instruments of subversion of the rights and of we the people, that war profiteering has become the career of choice for Washington insiders and former government officials, that the corporate-owned mass media has failed to cover the stories that the American people need to know about to understand what is happening in this country, and that we are, in fact, descending into a neo-fascist state. The underlying premise of the book is that if Thomas Jefferson was telling the truth, which I believe he was, that we the people own this government, then we have abdicated our responsibilities of ownership, and we are very close to losing any pretense to democracy, and that the critical moment is upon us where we have to take back our government and demolish the two-party corporate state as it presently exists. The website for the book, which is the easiest way to get it, is www.fixingamerica.org. Fixingamerica.org. And I began today what's called the National Truth Tour with an event at Detroit University Law School with the National Lawyers Guild. And the most significant event in this Truth Tour is going to be 1 week before the election, October 26th, at the National Press Club. And at the National Press Club, I'm going to be joined by a Christian minister, Muslim cleric, and Jewish rabbi, among others, hopefully including some members of Congress from both parties, who are going to issue a joint statement saying that based on the record of the administration of George W. Bush, that it must be made plain to Republicans and to Christians, most notably, that he is unfit on a moral basis for re-election and that he must be dumped from office on November 2nd.
All righty, John. Well, we will be, I'm sure many listeners will be tuning in, will be dialing up your website to get that information. We have been visiting with John Buchanan, the author of Fixing America, as well as a number of intriguing articles with the New Hampshire Gazette that we've accessed in the past. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record Program number 481, Interview with John Buchanan, being recorded on October 9th of 2004. For John Buchanan, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.